Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, friends, you're listening to The World Transformed on the Blog Talk Radio Network. The World Transformed is an audio production of Speculist Media. You can find us online at worldtransformed.com. This program explores a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. The World Transformed is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead. One that will be here sooner than you think, and one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. We're not here so much to tell you about the future as we are to encourage you to think about your future and to consider what may be the biggest transformation of them all, one that will occur in your world, in your life. The one that begins with recognizing and acting on the vast possibilities that are unfolding before you and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So, when does that amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing, man?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I am doing well also. I'm glad that we were able to go ahead and get the show going again this week. Had a little technical difficulty, didn't we?
Well, you know, we blame Blog Talk Radio frequently for our technical glitches. Sometimes they're Blog Talk Radio's fault, sometimes they're not Blog Talk Radio's fault, but I have to say, this week, it's their fault, without any hint of reservation on my part. They just weren't letting us do the show. We were calling in, we were entering all the right numbers, and we were being kicked off, so we decided that the smart move would be to go ahead and move the show to Thursday evening, and we thank everyone for tuning in this evening and listening to us either live on an unusual night or a day later on the podcast, if you typically get us the day after. Anyway, the show itself will still be the same show. I think that's the important point.
That's right. And it's a big one. We got a lot planned for tonight.
Yeah, we do. We got big topics to cover. I don't know, four shows, five shows worth of shows here in one evening, don't you think?
We sometimes bite off more than we can chew. We're about to find out if we did. It's going to be a packed show.
Well, with that in mind, why don't we leap into it? I described this week's show as changes that will change your life, and I came up with hardly a definitive list. Okay, this is a short list of possible changes, but I did a couple of things in putting this together. The first thing I did was I said I want to get some that are truly transformational around people's lives, and I wanted to kind of work from the near term and most plausible sounding to the far term and most kind of way out there sounding changes. So that's the progression we make along these four changes. Although I would say that number four on the list, while out there and extraordinary sounding, on the scale of topics that we talk about, it on the show generally, or that you and I deal with, Stephen, I'd say it's about halfway up the scale. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's not quite as weird as like the simulation hypothesis or other things like that. So yeah, we'll get kind of way out this evening, but about halfway up the scale, right?
Yeah. Somewhere about halfway up the old scale. Sorry about that. I was just bringing up a list of the list of topics so I could read it, and I went to our page where it it thinks the show is going on Wednesday evening when we're reporting this instead of Thursday when we're not. But unfortunately, Blog Talk Radio is trying to have our show without us, and we simply can't. We can't allow that.
Yeah.
So the four changes are coffee shopification, the post-jobs economy, the post-money economy, and life without death. Immediate change, one that we see happening right now, two that are kind of in the middle that are starting to emerge or that we might be moving towards, and then one that's a little bit out there and that requires that kind of a little bit of imagination to deal with it. But let's talk about that first one, coffee shopification. And that one is in particular your topic, Stephen, because you're the one who made the idea that in the future everything will be a coffee shop famous. So tell us about this coming change. What's the big change that's coming?
Well, here's the deal. And we can all see this happening around us. With bookstores closing right and left, I hear that Barnes & Noble is in trouble now. I hate this. I very much like bookstores. I bet you do too, Phil.
I do.
Who doesn't like, going and hanging out in the bookstore and browsing the and everything? But here's the deal. If you can have an entire world of books on your smartphone, or a larger screen, if you like, iPad or whatever it is that you have, and you can have that with all times, and the experience of reading that is comfortable, and you never run out of things to read, and the price is right. You can find books. A lot of books are free. Some books are very inexpensive by comparison to what you could. Books. Nothing's ever out of print, and then things that would never see the light of day, because maybe they're weird or because they're just a little, this just fills some small niche that a publishing house could never really print. These things can come home in the Kindle store and other places like that. So what's happening? We're seeing retail outlets like bookstores going away. Then Amazon, not just the Kindle part of Amazon, but Amazon as a whole is driving other businesses. Other businesses are struggling. Best Buy is in a lot of trouble. And one of the things is, people are walking through the aisles, pulling out their cell phones and saying, I can get this just $1 cheaper than I have it in a couple of days. That was, when I wrote the original coffee shop article, it was not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before. I was at a coffee shop doing all my Christmas shopping.
Right.
And thinking to myself, this is the way I'm going to Christmas shop forever. I'm never,
right,
ever going to go fight the crowds again. I'm going to do this, and, the gifts will show up at the house. If I choose, I can even have them gift wrapped before they show up. That's just the, and it worked out well that year, and it's worked out again this past Christmas, and I found that with programs like Amazon Prime and other online vendors are trying similar things, where shipping is free, or if you order just a little bit above maybe $50 or something, you get free shipping. What's the point of holding back? You end up having things shipped to you that you would never have dreamed of before. Even very inexpensive things that the shipping would have been more than the cost of the item. You just have it shipped to you. And that is a different way of looking at the world. It's a different way of shopping. So that's really the aspect of it. But there's other things too. When we say everything is becoming a coffee shop, we mean education as well. It's amazing the online courses that you can take at a coffee shop or wherever you like, that is beginning to really pressure on universities. They are it's kind of a shame that we have a general that spend a good half of their career paying off student loans.
Right.
That's just not sustainable when side by side you've got MITx, where that you absolutely free coursework, and they're beginning to offer some credential for it. And I think the credentialing part is going to come along very quickly with something really inexpensive like testing centers. You take the online course that you want, then you go to a local testing center, and they monitor you to make sure you're not cheating, and you take a test, and you get credit for the course. And then the university will give credit for that, and you can get a degree that way. Maybe at first it'll be just part of a degree, a certain number of hours you can get that way, and pretty soon more and more until, that's the way everybody gets their education. And it's turning the world upside down, and in many good ways. In some ways, I hate that we're losing our bookstores, but I see no way to, it's a one-way ratchet.
Right. Let's face it, you don't hate that we're losing our bookstores enough that you're going to personally commit to go buy $100 worth of books every month to try to keep them alive, right? I mean, that's the...
No.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I can't, if for every paper book I buy these days, Phil, I probably buy 20 Kindle books.
Right.
That's just the way I read.
I'm to the point where I'm absolutely irritated when I can't get it on my Kindle. It's just like it's such an inconvenience to have to deal with a real book. And I love books. It's the oddest thing to say that I don't want to have to deal with real books anymore. But I don't. If I want to get the information, if I actually want to read something, I want to read it. I'm to the point where I want to read it on my Kindle. Require kind of a luxury of time and carrying things around that I just most of the time don't have. If I'm on vacation, then I can read a regular book, but the rest of the time it just doesn't actually fit in with my life very well. But the big change we're talking about, Stephen, if I can characterize it, is it's a reduction or an elimination of physical presence or physical infrastructure.
Right.
For businesses and for organizations across the board. And in fact, it's interesting that you mentioned MIT, because they've been big drivers with MITx. And the company I work for, I'm in Boston this week. The company I work for during my day job is located in, speaking of MIT, an office space called the Cambridge Innovation Center, the CIC, which is owned by MIT, and essentially it's office space that's made available primarily for startups on a real ad hoc kind of a basis. A company that has just a very few resources can rent just an office or part of an office. You can come in and you can use cubicles, and there's like shared collaborative space. There actually are kitchens with where they serve coffee, and there's usually fruit and other kinds of snacks available. There's a little bit of recreational stuff around, so it's almost like the implementation already of the coffee shop idea for business. And, the idea is MIT is providing this facility as a way of kind of incubating, bringing up startup companies, helping companies to get big. And it's a really flexible kind of environment where if a company needs seating for three people, that's easy to get. And if 1 week you need seating for six instead of three, it's easy to make that change for that week, doing it month to month. So it's this not complete elimination of physical infrastructure, but just a completely different paradigm for physical infrastructure, where the whole office park, this is a high-rise building, 14 floors of businesses kind of piled up on top of each other. This whole office park is existing in a space very much like a coffee shop. And it only occurred to me today, I've been working in this place, we've occupied it for about a year now, how much it is really a realization of your vision of in the future everything being a coffee shop. We're all the companies located in the CIC are essentially working in a coffee shop.
Yeah, and I think your office space. More and more people are working from home too, and that's
right.
Part of this coffee shop idea too. It's the place that you are means less and less for the what work you're able to do and what people you're able to collaborate with. You can collaborate with anybody anywhere in the world. And so, it's good to have a place that's not home sometimes, where the kids can't find you perhaps, you can get
yep.
some stuff done. But it really matters very little where you are. It could be in a Starbucks. It could be in, an ad hoc office like that. It just doesn't matter anymore. And so, what we're able to do, one of the things that really drove the whole, we have to have offices now, was all the infrastructure that offices could provide that, individuals couldn't in the past. You couldn't have a computer in the 60s. No individual could. You couldn't have fax machines and copiers and everything else. So you would go to an office where everyone kind of shared these things. Now you can duplicate almost all of those functions with a single laptop, and so it just really doesn't matter where you are, except that unless you want to create a space where people can lay eyes on each other and collaborate in a physical space like that. And I guess that's what that's about.
When people work in a space together, it's going to be this temporary implementation of space where there's probably a computer connection of some kind, Wi-Fi for your smartphone, if nothing else. And it's flexible use, cheap or free, they're making their money, if at all, off the fact that you're there using the space, and maybe that you're buying something like coffee. That's the idea. That's the idea behind calling it the coffee shop. Either you can do everything from home, which you could have done all your Christmas shopping from home, or if you're in a space, it's a much scaled down, much more flexible, much less proprietary kind of space than what people have occupied in the past for doing work. And I think that's going to be a permanent shift. I think the
There's another
office as we
of,
know it is on its way out.
Okay.
Say again?
Well, and that is here now, and becoming more and more the case. Here in the next couple of years, we're in the middle of that transition right now. A little bit further into the future, there's another aspect of coffee shop location, and that's manufacturing.
Right.
3D printing is going to be a big deal, and some 3D printing will take place at home. On 3D printers in the home, but there's going to be a need for a place that could be like a coffee shop or an ad hoc office or whatever, where there'll be 3D printers that can do things that are a little more sophisticated, and maybe they cost a little more money. It'll take a manufacturing of a lot of products out of traditional manufacturing facilities and put it right there next to you so that you can completely make it your own. You can design it and design something from the bottom up, or take someone else's design and alter it just slightly to suit yourself, and make a one-off design.
Absolutely.
And,
Stephen? Let's come back to the 3D printing, because it's
okay.
going to play such a huge role in our third topic anyway.
Okay. All right.
But that's it's interesting to think. I hadn't made the connection before how that plays both into the coffee shopification and into the post money economy. And in fact, somewhere along the transition that you're talking about, before maybe we all have them, before we all have the ones that can do everything, some of us will have them, or they will exist in kind of a shared space. And that fits into the coffee shop model. But eventually they go into another model. And let's come back to that, and let's move on to the second transformation. So we'll swing back to 3D printers in a minute.
Can I throw something in before we do?
Sure.
I wanted to make note of a Forbes article entitled Three Major Tech Trends Transforming the Retail Landscape. It came out on the 21st, January 21st, in Forbes and online. And basically these three major tech trends, it talks about how, it was a disappointing shopping season this last time, and a lot of it was not disappointing for the online guys. It was disappointing for the retail guys, and so they talked about these three trends, and one of them is the e-commerce replacing the physical stores. Number two, smartphones are forcing retailers to keep prices competitive because people are comparison shopping right in their store. I mean, with their phones, that's got to be a little bit aggravating. And what's the third one? Anyway, Phil, that's pretty much it though. I thought it was interesting because it's very much all of the same ideas, you know.
Yeah, I think people are really becoming aware of these shifts. It's becoming much more real and much more accepted that's going to happen. And that's interesting because we've been talking about the coffee shop application for quite some time. But if we work our way down the list, you know, here's one we've been talking about for a couple 3 years now too, and I think this one's starting to sink in as well. That's the post jobs economy. Now I did a piece on Transparency Revolution last week that talked about this. I saw a piece on Facebook. It was actually over on the IEEE website that really caught my attention. Every now and then you read something and you just go, that is stunning. It just, it's one of those, it takes your breath away for a moment. It's this simple fact. Apple, Google, Facebook, and Amazon are worth $1 trillion. You add up the market capitalization of those businesses, they're worth $1 trillion, but they only create 150,000 jobs. It's math that can drive you bonkers. What's that?
That's all of them together?
Yes.
150,000 jobs. That's not even a large city.
Right.
That's a rather small city. Amazing. So, how does that break down? The amount of value each of those employees is contributing, it must be amazing.
It's $6.7 million per employee. That's what you're getting on average from those companies. Just to give a point of comparison, although valuation of a company and GDP are not by any stretch of the imagination the same thing, but if you divide up the GDP of the United States against the population of the United States, depending on who's doing the math and how they do the calculation, whether you count all citizens or whether you count just people who are potentially in the workforce or whatever, you get an answer that's somewhere between $25,000 and $100,000. Okay, so on the high end, we're all good for about $100,000 worth of value produced in this country. That's the average. These guys are, worth to their companies about 6,000 times that. Because they're so much more valuable? No, I don't think so. I think probably because machines are providing most of the value and it takes a lot fewer humans. That's actually what's happening. Not to say those people aren't valuable. They are making valuable contributions. But you don't get to that kind of multiplication of value being provided on your own. That is an evolutionary step. And it raises all kinds of interesting and troubling questions because our expectation throughout the 20th century is a model where you have a workforce, most people are in the workforce, most people spend most of their adult lives in the workforce. The workforce is all about you have a job, and by and large, having a job for most people means you work for some big company. I mean, that's the expected norm of the 20th century. Lots of exceptions to that, and lots of not everybody works for a big company, obviously. But if you were just going to point to the, if not the mean, to the median, or just kind of the expected norm, it was that. Especially probably in like the middle part of the 20th century, right? Everybody would think, well, you go work for a big company, right? They're the big providers of jobs. So chances are, if you go get a job, that's who you're going to be working for. And now we're saying, nope, big companies, they're getting more and more money, and they're doing it using fewer and fewer people. So what's going to happen?
With the original model, Phil, what you had was most adults working, but the few adults that weren't working generally were members of the same household where there was a worker, and they are doing something that's supporting that worker in some way.
That's right.
But if you have an economy, if we're moving to an economy where there's very few jobs, and then the potential of lots of families that are, you know, are unable to find a single job. Then what do you do with something like that? And what you're looking at is a situation that's not like a normal recession where there's no, you know, there's no wealth, or you know some sort of depression where there's no wealth. Actually, you would the economy as a whole would be clicking along better than ever, right? Producing more and more value, but just with less and less people working.
That's the fact. We're already seeing that over the last few years. We've been out of recession for a while, so although it's doing it sluggishly, the economy is growing, but the employment number is going down. And even when we see a slight uptick in employment, it's actually against a reduced expectation of the workforce. That is to say that so many people have left the workforce that we're not even counting as many heads as people working. Even when the unemployment rate goes down right now, it's still not reflecting the number of people working going back to what it was 5-6 years ago. It looks and feels right now like we might not ever get back to this. Not that the economy has contracted, because the economy is actually slowly moving back up, but that the workforce has contracted and seemingly in just that one direction. So yeah, it's this big change where automation produces ultimately unprecedented levels of wealth, wealth like we've never had it before, but the vast majority of that wealth is going to be increasingly concentrated in the hands of the owners of just a few mega corporations, these big companies like the ones I just named, and to a lesser extent, the people who work there. There's a rapidly dwindling number of people who actually work for those companies because, you know, they're all worth 6.7 million in value. Maybe they're going to start getting a bigger chunk of that than they currently get. So what happens? What do we do? Do we suddenly have a situation where everybody now works for small companies? That begs the question. That raises the question, I should say. Will those small companies create enough jobs? Will the opportunity be there? Or do we all work for ourselves? Can we implement an entrepreneurial model that's going to create enough jobs, quote-unquote, enough work for us all to be employed, or for the workforce to remain in some way the same size that it is? Or do we do something a little more radical? And I talked about a couple of those possibilities in the Transparency Revolution piece. One of which is this idea. Actually, they both rely on this concept that John Smart introduced to us a while back called taxing the machines. Basically, recognizing that if the machines are the ones producing all the value, we won't have as much compunction about levying taxes on them as we might on their human counterparts. So you tax the machines and you provide everybody in the country a living wage based on just kind of divvying the money up, or you tax the machines and you make individual owners out of the rest of the population. The people that would be the workforce now become the owners of horses. These are all possible remedies to that problem. The first two of which, we all go work for small companies or we all create our own businesses. We don't know if the economy is actually going to accommodate. And the second two, we're talking about massive social change, aren't we?
Yeah. And I believe that, quite frankly, my thought on this, Phil, is that your first two solutions are going to be, that's where people will go at first, but ultimately it won't be enough. And I think that one of the more radical solutions is where we're going to end up going. And, you know, I just, socialism there are a lot of problems with it. Just, and one of which is that we, you know, if we're paid to do nothing, then, you know, I would see that as corrosive to our creativity, to just the human experience. I don't think that I would enjoy living in a world like that. That would not be my first choice for how things would shake out. I think a little better, but in many ways it's the same. If the model where we all become owners of the businesses, you know, we become basically, you know, idle rich, trust fund kids in some ways. You know, I think it's slightly preferable to socialism in that with socialism, there's a tendency to just push the taxing more and more until the system tends to collapse, overspend or whatever. Whereas if you're an owner of the business, I think that there would be less of a tendency to push that issue and more to just maximize shareholder wealth by taking only what's an appropriate level. You know, anyway, it's going to be an interesting thing to live to see.
Well, and, I'll tell you, I think that I almost hesitate to call it socialism just because all of our terms kind of break down at this point. And it was really interesting in the article I linked where, off the top of my head, can't remember his name, but the guy who was making the argument in favor of a living wage was actually talking about this is the thing you have to do to preserve capitalism. And in fact, Martin Ford, who's been on Fast Forward Radio back when we were called that, made almost exactly that same case. If you want to have a market economy, if you want to have capitalism, the way you're going to have to do it is to invoke this practice that, you know, now you're using the word socialism to describe. So it's a funny kind of what do you call these solutions? Now, I would venture to say that it's probably just like currently we live in a world that is not purely anything. It's very likely that in the future we won't live in a world that's purely one thing or another, and that there will be some combination of people working for themselves, people owning their own business, people working for small organizations, some kind of flat-out payments being made to folks, maybe an expanded version of that wherein people are being paid to accomplish something so that it's not necessarily a job per se, but they're receiving a wage that's associated with education or with producing some research work or who knows what it would be, community service. There's any number of approaches that could be taken. I made the unfortunate mistake of referring to those in my blog post as meaningless jobs, and I don't really mean meaningless. What I mean is jobs that aren't actually providing any wealth into the economy. Ideally, they would be perfectly meaningful activities that people would be asked to do, the kinds of things that people want to do and that they could be good at and that would do some good for the world, but that would avoid, to some extent, the problem you were talking about, too, which is just this kind of, if everybody goes on the dole, you lose all incentive or you potentially lose incentive for people to make anything out of their lives, right? That life becomes kind of boring at that point. On the other hand, if everyone's an owner, then they have skin in the game. They have a little bit of a stake. And I think if you combine those two ideas, if people are both being paid to do something and maybe earning a share by doing something, then you get into a situation where people feel motivated. It's like, oh, well, maybe I'd like more, right? It would be good to have a little more of this. It would be good to be more involved, and the kinds of incentives that we currently have would find kind of a new life. They wouldn't be the exact incentives that we currently have, but they'd be versions of them, and it would I think enable a productive society, even though all the actual production is being done by the machine. So I think. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say that one more thing that we should probably throw into the mix. Imagine a life system that would encourage paying it forward. I'm sure you're familiar with that term, Bill. The movie and everything. Here's the idea. What if I see somebody needing help getting their tire changed, on the side of the road, and I stop and I help them, and they credit me with something on a social network. Imagine a Facebook and so I get a little, I get a little respect token or whatever, or maybe on the way home I've learned from Facebook or whatever that while I'm in the grocery store that there's a shut-in that's on my way home that needs some laundry detergent. So I pick that up and I take it to them. And it may be someone I've never life, you know. That kind of servicing others could actually be monetized in a kind of strange way through some sort of social network. You could do it as well. We could stay busy helping one another that way.
And that's great, because that one kind of dovetails into the next one, because part of what could ultimately happen there is in the model we're just now talking about, yeah, perhaps the reward you would get for that would take a monetary form, or you'd get the opportunity to take greater ownership or something like that. So you're kind of moving your way up in an economy that, at least at its bedrock, functions the way the economy we live in now does, which is to say it's all about money. But the next transformation we're talking about is one where even that idea goes away. So you know, getting our head around a world without jobs as we know them is a tricky one. Although we can imagine a world where value is still being exchanged and money is still being handed out based on certain criteria. And I think you and I are both agreed that it's better to do it based on some criteria than just to randomly hand it out.
Right.
But what happens in a world where there isn't money anymore? Could a world like that exist? Well, I think possibly it could. And in some ways that it reflects part of the solution, or maybe the ultimate solution, to the economy that doesn't have work, because the idea of getting past money is the idea of getting past scarcity. Ultimately, those two things go together, and the big change we're talking about here is just where abundance accelerates to the point, because we talked in the previous example of unprecedented levels of wealth. Well, here that change continues, and we get to a world where everyone is essentially experiencing post-scarcity, and it really doesn't matter if you're part of the 1% or the 0.1% who still has a job, or who were the original owners of the machines that produce the wealth. Ultimately, the resources that are needed to produce goods to meet both our needs and whatever we would want become widely distributed, become ultimately universally distributed. And I think it's that transition from widely distributed to universally distributed that we were getting at before when we were talking about coffee shop occupation, because there's going to be a coming time when a big part of the means to produce these things, which you're describing as, I think accurately, 3D printers, will be something that not everyone will have, or at least not everyone will have the big ones that can produce everything. But eventually we'll move in the direction where most of us will be able to produce an awful lot of things. And at that point, you start to look at a really interesting kind of a world. Is it a world where we have to go down to the coffee shop and print out our car? Or is it a world where I'm someone who produces one thing and you're someone who produces something else? And as in the days we were talking about, I think on the show last week, when humanity first began exchanging value with each other, we just start finding each other, and we start exchanging value without there necessarily being any money involved. You know, there's this very real possibility that we get good enough at producing stuff. The production of material goods becomes an information technology, and we can essentially get by with a lot less money. We can grow our own food, and we can make our own stuff, and to the extent that we make everything we need, that's great. To the extent that we don't, we ultimately implement something not unlike barter with others to make up for the rest. Now, the question is, in that kind of a world, would a new currency emerge? And would it be maybe something like on social networks where, since everybody already has everything they need, we start living in a currency that is more built around recognition or appreciation of contribution or just moral goodness or something like that? What do you think, Stephen? Is that too far out, or is that on the roadmap?
I think it's a likely way of things could go. There was a very interesting novel that incorporated that idea, and instead of calling it money, called it Woofy, right? I mean, it was basically respect.
Right.
You know, if you did something great, You know, you were credited with Woofie. It was a measure of the respect that you had for the things that you've done for society.
Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, Cory Doctorow.
Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, that's right. And it was Cory Doctorow.
Yep.
Yep, good novel. Very interesting how he, the whole point of the novel was, you know, Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom, we're down, but it doesn't matter because we all have everything we want. It's an interesting kind of, you have to get your head around it. It's a little bit different. And I wanted to bring up this other aspect of this. You know, we talked about 3D printers. The other half of the 3D printer, of course, is where are you going to get the stuff that you use, the filament that you use to print stuff with?
Right.
There's an interesting device I learned about just this week, Phil, called the Filabot. Have you heard of it?
No.
Okay, the Filabot, it got its start, it was a Kickstarter project, and it's now a real thing. You throw your plastic junk into it, and it chews it up, and it melts it down, and it creates filament for 3D printers out of your plastic junk in your house. And it's we had kind of years ago on the Speculist, Phil, we had talked to you and I, but that's reality now. That's no longer sci-fi.
So the filament. It's producing the stuff you need to make more stuff. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. That's right. The filament is like a, if you're unfamiliar with a 3D printer, probably the closest thing you would it would seem like to you is the stuff that those tubes that go into the hot glue guns.
Yeah.
They're round. They're you know they can be that size. They can be smaller. Talking about it's the tube or the plastic that goes into these 3D printers, and the Filabot makes this plastic tube filament out of your plastic junk in your house. So just when some plastic toy is broken, or you're throwing out your the plastic grocery bags that you brought home, or you've drank the water bottle and you don't want to just throw it in the dump. Throw it off in this thing, and it'll create a filament. It's the if you think about it, that's the ultimate recycling because you're not sending it off someplace where it may or may not be recycled. It's and it'll become some other thing at some point for you right there. It's a pretty neat idea.
It speaks to a really important part of the no money future. One of the interesting aspects explored in another Cory Doctorow book, the book Makers, the novel Makers, which in some ways is a prequel to Down and Out in the Magic Kingdom. It describes a world that's kind of leading in that direction. One of the things that goes on in that book is that people increasingly are making better and better use of what otherwise would have been discarded items, junk items. There's a really interesting sequence of that novel that takes place in essentially a squatter village, which is this kind of luxury, high-tech squatter village that people are able to live in, and it has to do with the fact that abundance is creating a wealth of resources for us that technology is making it possible for us to make better and better use of. So those two things kind of work together, and we have more value at our disposal and better capability to make use of that value than we've had in the past, and it makes us less reliant on money. And that's part of the interesting discussion that erupted in both the comment thread over Transparency Revolution and a few places on Facebook when I posted the post-jobs piece last week, was this point that people like to make about, well, you know, there was a time when people didn't have jobs. People haven't always had to have jobs. That hasn't always been how the world worked. Our hunter-gatherers didn't have jobs per se, right? They didn't punch a clock, and they didn't take a paycheck. And even in the medieval world, even either the ancient world or the pre-industrial world, employment was a far cry from the way we've defined it here, particularly in the last couple of centuries. The big difference being that money has become the way that we get what we need. I mean, it's ultimately kind of the one of the fundamental requirements for survival. And the reason is that it's the means by which we get the resources for staying alive. But now, if suddenly the resources are coming to us in a much more direct way, because we're becoming, as we've talked about here so often, becoming much more capable, because we're able to, as we've noted, do more and more with less and less, maybe the money thing becomes less important, and something else emerges to become equally important, or maybe even more important. It's a sweeping change, but I think it's one that possibly can happen.
I think that on our way to that, Phil, it's going to be kind of a rocky ride. I personally am going to do my best to have some of these things like Google and Apple and some of these things that are likely to deliver the future to us. I intend to own some stock, you know.
That's not a bad idea. Yeah. But hopefully the government eventually starts issuing us all stock, or the system does. But maybe ahead of that, it's not a bad idea to go ahead and acquire a share or two on your own. I think that's very sound advice. Just in case we don't switch to a no money economy quite as quickly as we'd like to, find a way to have some money. Would that be sound advice?
For a while, yeah. For the foreseeable future, money's good.
We're not suggesting anyone prematurely divest themselves of the money paradigm, that's for sure. And we don't intend to before the time is right. I think that's an important caveat that you make this. We're suggesting that when the world's ready to move on for money, you be ready, but please don't try to be the leader there. Unless you really know what you're doing.
The bleeding edge there. I don't want to be a part of that.
I do not either. Okay, so that takes us to our fourth and final and biggest transformation, biggest change that will change your life. And this one is hardly a stranger to this program or to any of the blogging we've done or any of the talking that we've done. But it shows you how far things can change and how weird things can get. And that is the idea of life without death, which I realize is a misnomer. That's a misstatement of the concept. We're really talking about, what is it, life without a built-in limit to lifespan, life without the necessary expectation of death, without death being imminent. That's really the change we're talking about, isn't it?
That's right. And we're not even talking about life without aging, because if you're alive, things tend to break down. So what we're talking about is the ability to repair the damage that aging causes on a periodic basis as often as we need it. And that sounds bizarre to a lot of people, but people like Ray Kurzweil have introduced these concepts to a lot of us. And when we get to thinking about it, you know, why can't we fix the body? You know, it's very, very complicated, but it's if we understand it to a greater extent, then we can fix the problems that make us old. And there's nothing magic going on in the aging process. It's something that we can address if it's not magic, right?
That's right.
There's no indication it's magic. It's just something that's happening to us that we can perhaps address, given the appropriate level of technology. Go ahead, Phil.
I was just going to say, as that becomes increasingly addressable, what we find is we reach an inflection point. We reach a point where I think it's a few key breakthroughs. Aubrey de Grey will tell you 7 for aging, and maybe there's a couple others to get rid of all diseases, but ultimately there are a few key breakthroughs that will occur, I think most likely in genetic medicine and in nanomedicine, that are going to essentially render aging and render all diseases curable.
Yeah. And You know, one of the big ones that we deal with in our modern world, Phil, is obesity, diabetes, heart disease, arthritis. These are the diseases of the affluent world, and they're not so much a problem in places that are still developing countries. World has these problems, and just a few key developments. The ability for us to be able to control weight at and remain slender all our lives with adjusting our metabolism in some ways. That some breakthroughs in those would deliver us from type 2 diabetes, a great deal of the heart disease that we have. So I mean, like you say, it's a few things that we need to get a lot better at, and once we are, we can it'll deliver us from a lot of problems physically.
Yeah, and Stephen, when you put it that way, I think it raises the necessary point that we have to make, which is that as with some of these other changes that won't all occur, and we won't live in a world of cure. We probably won't live in a world that aging and all disease has really disappeared. We'll get better and better and better, and most of them will be gone, and then finally all of them will be gone. But there'll be a long transition here, most likely.
And I agree. What will be interesting to see is, how old is the oldest person, Phil, that gets to live to see these things? The truth is, none of us know. I threw out some advice about owning some stock in some of these companies that's going to deliver the future to us. I would say also, take good care of yourself. You want to live long enough to see this stuff, and if you live long enough, you may find that you reach a point where you don't have to die of old age. It might be a bus that hits you in 1,000 years, but old age is not what gets you, and that would be an exciting thing to live to see.
Absolutely. Although exciting, it's a big set of changes we're talking about, because we're talking about the need to rethink everything, right? Education, careers, relationships, basically the whole plan and design that we have for human life becomes significantly different, doesn't it?
Yeah, we get our education as young people, we have a career, then we retire, and we sit in our rocking chairs for a year or two or a few years and fade and we die. That's the model that we have right now. And once you throw out the aging, then all of a sudden it might not make sense to front load all your education at the beginning. Well, you might get a good portion of your education at a young age, a career, and then you go get some more education and do something different. And so you go from career to career, you're perhaps the education is, you get that during sort of a period of sabbatical or something where you're away from work. But, of course, again, that's a world where there is some work still.
That's right. We've already eliminated the need for work as it's been known. So will careers even still exist?
If careers, at least we've always thought of them, are really not around anymore, and aging is not a part of the picture too. Life is very, very different.
Last call.
All
last
right,
thank
call. You, Erica.
Okay.
Well, we're having too much fun with that, but with just a few minutes left, Stephen, let me ask you a couple of parting thoughts on these, because I think that you're making the good point that they curl up on each other, right? They sort of reflect back on each other, and one huge change added to another huge change doesn't make two huge changes. It makes almost an unrecognizable world, doesn't it? But I think as we presented them here, they're in the right order. And do you think that they're presented in sort of their relative level of imminence?
Yeah, I as a matter of fact, I do think we our order is more or less correct. There's a lot of overlap. I think we're in the middle of coffee shopification right now, and the post-jobs economy would come after that, and you know, and the post-money economy comes after that. I think the whole business of you know, curing disease, you know, curing all diseases, and taking care of you know, aging, that happens in of the post-money economy, or maybe the post-jobs economy. It begins happening at that point. So I think we got our order more or less right with some overlap. What do you think?
I think so, too. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I put it in that order because I think that's the direction it will go. And I think the bottom line is the world will just keep getting stranger. But fortunately, we'll get used to it as it goes. And it won't seem any stranger then than it does today. So that's the thing to look forward to. All right, we'll let that be the final word. Eric, what is our music?
Sundown by Lloyd.
All right, Lloyd singing Sundown. Thank you for putting that together. Thanks, both of you, for your flexibility on doing a show on a night other than our regular nights. We'll be back at the regular time next week, assuming that our network is cooperative. And until next time, live to see it.